Next case on our calendar is 08-1946, 08-1949, Bazonia Benton versus Hamilton County Educational Service Center. Ms. Porter.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Mr. Bellman, my colleague, will take 6 minutes of time, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We once again are here on the issue of what question can or cannot be appealed to the Common Pleas Court under Revised Code 41-3023-512. The Commission would like to ask the court to follow its precedent, which has been consistent in saying that only the allowance, the disallowance, or the discontinuance of a claim may be appealed. A failure by the Commission to discontinue a claim should remain unappealable under Revised Code 41-23-512. There are several reasons that the court should continue on its precedent here. First of all, even though the charge here of fraud may seem to go on the merits to the original claim, in fact, the Bureau and the Industrial Commission don't really treat it as expunging the entire claim. They treat it as a discontinuance of a claim if a fraud contention comes up after the fact, after the original 512 claim is finalized. Secondly, there are several practical problems with going to a 512 after a 512, after an original claim has been finalized.
Counsel, before you over here at the other end.
Sorry.
That's all right, the sound.
The acoustics are weird in here.
Not the justices, but the acoustics, thank you.
Absolutely, not the justices.
Before you get into that, could you just help me understand what does, if this is to invoke the continuing jurisdiction of the Industrial Commission.
Correct.
What does the Industrial Commission have any standards that they look at in order to determine whether or not they are going to invoke the jurisdiction, or do they just take the facts and decide whether it looks like they ought to?
Well, I believe that's actually set forth in case law. I think the case is Nichols, in which there are five things that have to have occurred. One of five things have to have occurred for them to invoke continuing jurisdiction. And they did, I'll be honest with you, I don't remember which one they cited here, but they did invoke their continuing jurisdiction to look at this question, but then decided in the end that there was no evidence, in fact, that no new evidence at all had been put forward indicating that there had been fraud. And I think this comes to one of the real problems that we have here. If an employer can bring up fraud after the fact and come back and make an allegation of fraud and then go to a 512, it's really just a way to get around the statute of limitations under 512, which is, as you know, is only 60 days. Rather than bringing their evidence at the beginning and then going through the 512 process, this basically was a whoops. Oh, geez, you know, we should have said something originally. It's too late. Let's try to get continuing jurisdiction and try to get it into a 512 that way.
But if was there any allegation in this case that the fraud could not have been discovered? It was newly discovered and could not have been discovered with reasonable diligence originally?
Right. The conclusion of the hearing officer at the Industrial Commission was that there was no new evidence that was presented to support the fraud. And I have no reason to disagree with the SHO on that determination.
If you have a case in which there was new discovered evidence,
right,
they could reopen it under continuing jurisdiction.
They could reopen it under continuing jurisdiction.
And under your theory, if they find again, the fraud was not established, you would argue no right to appeal.
No right to appeal under 512, but of course they would have a right to go through the mandamus
right
route.
Now, if they make a finding of fraud and they terminate benefits, is there a right to appeal?
The claimant would have a right to appeal just as they did in the other cases, White and Felty and so forth.
So the claimant could appeal the finding of fraud, the employer could only appeal in mandamus.
That's correct. And as unequal as that sounds, I don't think there's a problem. First of all, this case already determined in Thomas that there was not a problem with that. And secondly, 512 is already inherently a difficulty for the claimant when the employer appeals under 512, because they're basically being forced to be a plaintiff in a civil lawsuit. Whereas when the claimant files a 512, they can make that determination. Is it worth it? Is it worth it to go through this litigation to file this lawsuit or not? Again, of course, also in 512, when the employer brings it, even though the employer brings it, the claimant always has the burden of proof. So it's inherently unfair. No, I wouldn't say unfair. It's inherently unequal, the 512 process. And so the fact that there's some inequality in when you can and can't appeal a continuance or discontinuance really isn't a problem.
This case doesn't really fit neatly into either a right to participate or extended disability.
Correct.
Does it? It's a unique case. You argued in your brief, of course, that we should treat it as an extended disability case, but it doesn't really fit. Let me hear your strongest argument. It doesn't look like a extended disability
right.
case. Does
I think it? On the I think that's true on the merits that it doesn't feel like an extended disability, but this court has consistently found that 512 jurisdiction should be used very sparingly and for very narrow cases. So when you have kind of a gray case like this, I think looking at the court's case law, you toss it back over into the not a 512. For all the reasons given in Felty and Afrades and Evans and White and Thomas, all those cases in which we want that 512 jurisdiction to be extremely narrow and well-defined. So if it's not well-defined, as you say, in a case like this where it doesn't really fit into either category, for practical reasons and also for the reasons given in those cases, we think it ought to be put in the extent of disability bin.
That line of cases to which you just referred is, it seems to favor saving the common pleas courts from
yes.
many appeals.
Yes.
But it doesn't save the Court of Appeals from mandamus actions.
No, it doesn't. But
that's
the Court of Appeals has really become kind of at least the 10th District has become kind of an expert yeah. in interpreting workers' compensation. And I think, again, that's actually a reason to put it over into the mandamus category, in that that court has the expertise to look at it and determine whether or not it's an appropriate workers' comp. I'm going to turn over to Mr. Bellman now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. Mr. Bellman.
Mr. Bellman, do you have any idea what the percentage of fraud allegations are in worker comp? Is it rare? Is it 5%? Do you have any feel for that?
Your Honor, I've been a practitioner for about 12, 13 years, and I've had two.
Okay, so pretty rare.
Yes.
So even if we were to find it's really a cutoff of disability, that's not going to create an inundation of the common pleas.
I think it will, because it creates a huge loophole, because it substitutes a motion for continuing jurisdiction is being used as a substitute to file a valid appeal to the allowance of the claim. Ms. Benton's claim was allowed based upon a BWC order that was not appealed. Her subsequent
but
right
only,
to
But only in those cases where you have proof of fraud. It's not going to open the door to any case. It's just the case where the fraud determination is made.
A request for continuing jurisdiction can be requested any time a claim is alive. I have claims from the 70s, from the 80s, from the 90s. Anytime, if a claim is still alive, and usually it's the more expensive claims where treatment is continuing or pay is continuing, that there's an incentive to look for a way out of the claim. And by filing a motion, shotgun approach, a motion for continuing jurisdiction based upon fraud, if it sticks, great, but if it doesn't, if it's a right to participate issue, they go right into the common pleas court, where in most instances, an injured worker doesn't have the wherewithal to defend a common pleas trial case on something that happened years ago. The opposing counsel in their brief indicated that there's a five-year look-back on the new statute effective October 11th of 2006. That's only for claims after October 11th of 2006. And it's not just 5 years from the date of injury. It's 5 years from the date of injury or the last payment of the bill or the last payment of compensation, whichever is later. It just keeps getting pushed out. For claims prior to 2006, October 11th, it's 10 years from the last payment of compensation. You can see why there's a huge tail on these claims. And it is significant because it's an end around race judicata.
But if you have evidence of fraud.
If you have evidence of fraud.
And it comes up later, and you prove that this was all made up, this person never should have received this, why isn't that a right to participate?
If the Industrial Commission finds fraud, then it is a right to participate. Right to participate and extent of disability, Felty talked about that. You have right to participate issues, and everything else falls into the bin considered extent of disability. And Felty, in 1992, the Supreme Court issued three decisions within a nine-month period, Felty, Evans, and Afraides, with the hope that this would give the bar direction on rights to appeal into court or whether it's a mandamus action. And Felty indicated that unless a narrow reading of 512 is adhered to, almost any decision could end up in common pleas court. Once the right to participate is determined, no subsequent rulings, unless a ruling terminates the right to participate, is appealable to common pleas court.
So if you have a finding of fraud that says you should never have got the money in the first mm-hmm. place, that is not a determination of the right to participate.
That is a determination of if they find fraud, yes. If they don't find fraud, as in the case of Ms. Benton, it's not a right to participate.
So you're confusing me. So if they find fraud, you are agreeing that's a right to participate.
Correct.
If they don't find fraud, you're saying that's not a, yeah. not allowing them to continue, that determination's already been made.
It did not determine the injured worker's right to participate or to continue to participate. That finding had been made when the initial claim was allowed and when additional conditions, the right to continue to participate was approved.
So you're claiming that then the mandamus action will force companies to only appeal those cases where they really have a strong argument of abuse of discretion.
Yeah, and the Court of Appeals, the 10th District, has streamlined to handle mandamus actions in workers' comp because they recognize that right to appeal at common pleas would bog down the system if any issue made it into the Court of Common Pleas. And that's why it's restrictive and that's why it's reserved for only decisions that terminate the right to participate.
Justice,
mentioned earlier, continuing jurisdiction can be raised by five different issues after a claim is allowed. Fraud, mistake of fact, mistake of law, newly discovered evidence, or an error by an inferior tribunal. Those are the only five.
And I assume there's fraud subsequent to the allowance.
There can be, yes.
And there would maybe be fraud involved in the initial allowance.
Correct.
And we are, this case involves an allegation of fraud in the initial allowance.
Correct.
Under continuing jurisdiction. And would to be successful with a claim of fraud, would that require newly discovered evidence as well?
Well, attached to the employer's motion was a list of documents which weren't newly discovered, time logs, attendance rosters, all that information was readily available to them at the time of the initial allowance. But they didn't allege newly discovered evidence. They alleged fraud, but they listed that as their evidence. But the staff hearing officer found absolutely no evidence that Ms. Benton had misrepresented her intentions when she was injured that day. She was traveling in the course and scope of her employment. Found absolutely no evidence. Those are his words. Chief Justice Moyer indicated that things don't fit neatly. I think this case does fit neatly into the extent of disability bin, because as Felty and Afraides and Evans indicated, that unless the decision terminates the right to participate, and it did not, then you can pursue an appeal in a court of common pleas. And that's still good law.
Well, it's not, but it's not extended disability from the standpoint of the mandamus cases in the 10th District. No. It's always a question of whether the commission abused its discretion by assessing certain disability to a claimant. So in that sense, it's not a...
No, in that sense, it's not, but overpayment
by
issues...
By default, maybe it is, but other...
Anything that's not a right to participate issue just gets thrown in at
that's the only way you get it.
And it's created a legal fiction, calling it extended disability.
Exactly.
But it could be treatment issues, overpayment issues, temporary total issues, permanent total issue, just anything other than the termination of the right to participate.
And if the Industrial Commission, well, if they had found fraud, then of course we've got the right to participate issue.
Correct.
It's exploring this question about because this is fraud alleged in the initial claim as opposed to fraud that arises subsequent to the initial allowance. The court would determine that this is a right to participate issue, there should be an appeal. What is a practical consequence of that? Can the appeal be limited simply to the employer having to establish fraud, or does it in fact require the claimant to start from the beginning with the burden of proof to prove their claim all over again with the fraud then being used simply as a defense rather than as an offense?
First, res judicata would be rendered meaningless if it's allowed to be appealed in the court, that final binding orders that aren't appealed have really no standing. If a motion for continuing jurisdiction, even if it's denied, you get appealed in the court, the employer or whatever party is in no worse position than if they had not appealed the order. Now, getting back to your question, that the as far as your can you clarify the last thing you said?
Yes, if the appeal were allowed,
okay,
would the burden be on the claimant to reestablish the claim? Or would the burden be on the employer to establish fraud?
And that's what, in a workers' compensation appeal to court, the injured worker always has the burden, always. And that's what makes this so difficult, because in the Brown case, it talked about that, where the injured worker actually had the burden of proof in fraud. And the court even admitted that it hadn't proved, the employer hadn't proved all the elements, but it went to a jury trial and he was found guilty of fraud. The injured worker in a workers' comp appeal pursuant to 512 always has the burden of proof. And it's a burden of proof to show that he was injured in the course and scope of his employment. And just one
you
thing.
Use your time, you need to quickly.
I'm sorry, just in a fraud case, then the question becomes, is the injured worker open to damages? Workers' comp law certainly doesn't provide that in the statutory framework as far as the right to participate. It's never mentioned. But in a common law fraud, civil fraud, there are damages. There's so many questions that this issue would create, which hasn't been addressed by this court. It would really be a nightmare, and it is a huge loophole.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
Mr. Lampe.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is David Lampe. I'm the attorney for the Hamilton County Educational Service Center. I believe the crux of this appeal starts with and ends with the actual motion that was filed by the employer with the Industrial Commission. If you look at that motion, there is a clear designation that it was a motion for a finding of fraud in conjunction with the initial claim for participation in the Workers' Compensation Fund. In fact, the motion specifically requests the court to find that because of this fraud that was committed, Ms. Benton was not within the course and scope of her employment.
Now, is this newly discovered fraud based upon newly discovered evidence, or is this simply a newly discovered argument in the existing facts that were before the commission?
Your Honor, I would say that this was newly discovered evidence by the employer. This was something that they had not discovered at the time that the appeal period had expired. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I believe the Gobich decision that this court rendered back in the 90s may have some bearing on this. One of the basis for invoking the continuing jurisdiction of the Industrial Commission is fraud. Appellants seem to want to merge that sole basis for invoking the Industrial Commission's continuing jurisdiction with newly discovered evidence. I found no case law that says you need to have fraud that is newly discovered in order to invoke the court's the Industrial Commission's continuing jurisdiction. If there is fraud, this is the same argument that I raised to the Industrial Commission, it shouldn't matter if it's discovered in conjunction with the first report of injury, or in this case, 11 months after the fact.
Well, there's two kinds of fraud, aren't there? There's would be fraud that figures in the initial allowance, and then there could be fraud that arises subsequent to the initial allowance that would justify discontinuing workers' compensation benefits from that point, as opposed to back to the time of allowance.
And that is a very good analysis. And in fact, this court, in three of the cases that were cited by appellants, referenced that fraud that occurred subsequent to the initial claim being allowed in the workers' compensation claim. For example, the White case, you've got a case where the spouse of the decedent is granted death benefits. I believe it was 6 to 7 years after she's collecting on death benefits, she gets remarried. Because she gets remarried, those death benefits stop. That marriage later gets annulled. Because of the annulment, it's essentially found that that marriage did not exist. In that case, you've got an issue here where you're dealing with benefits that stop midstream. And that's not what we're dealing with here. We're talking about a case where we are asking the court to find fraud in the initial claim to participate here.
Well, I guess what I follow up on Justice Cupp's question, I think it's an important one. If the information was available to the employer when the employer did not appeal or did not challenge the granting of the awarding of the claim to the employee, why should the employer be able to go back now and say, well, there's evidence that we could have found, apparently it was part of the records of the employer, of your client. Why should we open up, why should we permit an opening of that when the employer essentially missed its chance? And maybe I'm overstating it, but that seems to be the argument of the appellants.
You know, and I thought of that issue leading up to this argument, and really I think you've got to look at the nature of fraud. I mean, you're dealing with a knowing misrepresentation of some key component to this claim. There is an action, either an actual misrepresentation or a concealment of the facts. So that I think that could put a burden on employers to make certain that within that appeal period, you need to find and discover that concealment or misrepresentation. Otherwise, under their analysis, if it's newly discovered evidence, if you haven't found it within that appeal period, essentially, if you haven't discovered fraud during that appeal period, you lose the right to challenge.
Well, if the fraud is concealed and it's found later at some point, it seems to me that's different. The facts here are, tell me, are the appellants wrong when they say that the timesheets were available and so forth? They could have been checked. They could have, you know, there could have been some, I don't want to suggest how the case should have been tried, certainly, but that seems to be an important issue.
Well, two things. Since this is a motion to dismiss, as this court's aware, the allegations as alleged in the complaint are to be taken by the court as true. Secondly, before this case was dismissed, we had not gotten into discovery. Had we gotten into discovery, it would have been made clear to opposing counsel that we're dealing with issues involving the application of HIPAA, the access to medical records. We're dealing with an employee who's claiming to pick up medical records. We don't have signed authorizations for release of medical records under HIPAA to get those records. All of those things that my client, had they had an intimate knowledge of the new HIPAA laws back in 2003, could have asked those questions.
Well, now that's even worse, isn't it? You just said if if your client hadn't been ignorant about the law, they would have put on a different case. But I mean, that you're just digging the hole deeper, aren't you?
I don't think, Your Honor. The bottom line is this was not evidence that was readily before them at the time that the decision needed to be made to determine whether or not to actually
whose
appeal.
Fault is it that it wasn't before them? They didn't do the appropriate discovery or gathering of the information. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, we believe the issue, again, goes back to the issue of fraud. If you have a knowing misrepresentation or a concealment of the facts, this would have been something that could have been readily apparent.
Did the employee here do anything to thwart the discovery of the documents necessary? In other words, destroy them, hide them, collude with somebody not to bring them forth? What kind of fraud, other than she said, I was on the job and I got injured.
Right.
And then the medical records or the employment record, timesheets, et cetera, she didn't do anything to disrupt those, did she?
No, we haven't discovered any evidence of actual destruction or removal of records, no, Your Honor.
And you did have an initial hearing before a magistrate on the decision to reopen, and the magistrate found no evidence. So it's not like you had no recourse. You had an initial hearing, and to me, it seems to me the issue here is not how sound was your case, or whether you timely or didn't. The issue is, could you appeal that finding to the Common Pleas Court, or do you have to go to mandamus? Isn't that the actual legal issue?
The legal issue here is exactly that. The staff hearing officer, despite we put on evidence, produced substantial evidence, the staff hearing officer disagreed.
And the legal argument is that when there is no finding of fraud, when your case is not reopened, that's just an extent issue. If you reopen it, find fraud, and terminate, now you truly have a termination issue, which generates the right to an appeal. But in your case, you weren't successful, and so there is continuing payments, and it's still a continuing, that seems to be their argument, that it's not a termination because you were not successful.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think the issue before the court is not whether or not the party was successful or not. It's the actual underlying motion that was sought before the Industrial Commission. And that was clearly to seek fraud in the initial claim to participate. This court in the White case distinguished between its case in which the court was presented before it an intervening dog attack several years after the party, the claimant had participated in the workers' compensation fund. The court started down the analysis that I believe the First District Court of Appeals here correctly followed, was that this was the White case dealt with a discontinuation of workers' compensation benefits midstream. Here we're dealing with an initial claim for benefits similar to the Jones and Massillon cases. So we believe there is a distinction there. The problem is you don't have a neat fit in claiming that this is an extent of disability issue. The employer here is not challenging the extent of the claimant's disability. They are seeking an order saying that from the initial claim for participation, the claimant should not be entitled to participate in the workers' compensation.
How much time should they have to raise that issue? Can they raise it any time, 10 years after, 12 years after, 20 years after?
Well, again, as referenced in our brief, there is a 5-year statute of limitations for the Industrial Commission to exercise continuing jurisdiction.
What if they just find the fraud after 5 years? Can't raise it?
I would say after the statute of limitations has expired, you cannot. Mm-hmm.
And is there a conflict then between the First District's decision and the others? And isn't that really the issue we have here?
Well, I believe the First, 10th, and 5th districts are in conflict with two other appellate districts. That's correct, Your Honor.
How does your position affect the res judicata argument? I mean, normally the party has the adjudication, there's the right to appeal, that period passes, that resolves everything.
Right. And let me begin my response to that by explaining that this is not an avenue of appeal that the employer is preferring to seek. Obviously, this is a much easier case for the employer had they discovered the fraud during the initial appeal period. Now that we are pursuing a claim for fraud, the employer believes that this is a different claim from the initial right to participation claim. We're dealing here with having to prove that the elements of fraud, essentially, and I would agree with Mr. Bellman that the claimant still has the burden to show that they have the right to participate in the case. But I believe the employer has the burden to show that there was some type of false representation knowingly made with an intent to induce reliance. So there is a burden that is placed on the employer in this case as well. In order, since we are dealing with an appeal of a fraud motion, I believe the employer does have to prove the elements of fraud.
If we were to decide that this, when you don't succeed in reopening, that is an a mandamus only, do you have enough to succeed in mandamus in this case?
Well, as referenced by the Attorney General in their brief, in a mandamus action, we are obviously dealing with a much tougher road to hoe here. We have to prove that the Industrial Commission essentially had no evidence to support their decision. We're dealing with an abuse of discretion review, and as referenced by the Attorney General, this is oftentimes done by simply a paper hearing. We won't have a right to actually put on evidence before the court should this proceed with a mandamus action, and we believe that that is not a correct way to follow here, since this is not an extent of disability issue.
Mr. Lampe, looking at the statute, and I've applied the statute for many, many years, and it's just interesting that I'll ask Ms. Porter, this is going to sound like a sort of a give me to you, but the statute is written not in terms of sort of protecting. We've got this case law that says we sort of protect the number of cases that go to the Common Pleas Court, but the statute is written in terms of any injury or occupational disease other than a decision as to the extent of disability goes to the Common Pleas Court, which is just the reverse of, seems to me, of our case law, because it says everything other than extent of disability goes to the Common Pleas Court. And you want to comment on that?
Yeah, and Your Honor, I believe the court's decisions on this issue has over the years diverted further and further from the clear language of the statute.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe Lipushak was the first to say, okay, we understand that the statute says that an employer may appeal an order of the Industrial Commission in an injury case other than a decision as to the extent of disability, but we understand that there are extent of disability issues and we're going to confine and restrict these to a certain degree. But in this case, I believe we're taking the step to going into a realm of not having any reasonable relation back to the statute if we're essentially saying, okay, if the employer was successful in bringing this motion to find an initial finding of fraud on the initial claim, then the benefits are terminated and we have a proper appeal under 512 since it's a decision other than an extent of disability. But since the employer wasn't successful, even though the motion relates back to the initial claim for relief, we're really going to treat it as an extent of disability issue. There's no intent by the employer in this case to challenge the extent of Ms. Benton's disability. We're asking the court to not grant it at all based on fraud. So I believe that is directly the court's ruling in that matter would take a step back towards a more direct interpretation of 512.
Thank you, Mr. Lampe.
Right, thank you.
Ms. Porter, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds, and I'll give you a chance. You're an authority in this area. You argue these cases. What's your response to my, it seems to me the default position is everything goes to the Common Pleas Court unless it's extended disability.
That might seem to be true just looking strictly at the statutory
language.
There are a couple different reasons why I would disagree with that. First of all, this case law has been out there since at least 2000, the Lipushak case, maybe even before, depending on which case you want to go back to. The General Assembly has revised the workers' comp statutes at least a couple of times since then. They are presumably well aware of the case law, and yet they have done nothing to change or indicate that 512 should be interpreted any differently than what the court has been interpreting it all these years. And secondly, there are two things in the language of 512 that, at least in this case, indicate that this case should be treated as an extended disability. One is the statute of limitations. In this case, really, what the employer is doing, they have evidence that they could have brought up in the original claim. They could have brought it up in the additional conditions claim that came along a few months later. But rather than doing that, they went and tried to get continuing jurisdiction. It's basically an end around the 60-day statute of limitations in 512. There's a reason for a statute of limitations. They want these cases to be limited. Once the administrative process is over, they want people to give, they want to give both employers and claimants a limited possibility and opportunity to appeal. This is just an end around that language. And then also the inherent disability that a claimant is under 512. The claimant always has the burden of proof no matter what. And it allows, if you allow somebody to keep just getting continuing jurisdiction and bringing up things that might theoretically go to the original claim, you're simply allowing the employer to drag the claimant into court over and over against their will, over and over again, to have to go through discovery, to have to go through all the things that you do in a civil lawsuit, rather than taking their shot the first time, which is what they should have done. I mean, I think an employer has some responsibility in a case like this where the evidence for fraud, or the alleged evidence for fraud, it was not newly discovered. It was available to them in the original claim. They have some responsibility, as you would in any court case, in any administrative case, to discover, to investigate, and discover that evidence up front. And if they don't discover it up front, there has to be some concept of waiver. I mean, if you don't bring forward evidence you have when you have your opportunity, you've waived it. And if you do away with waiver, if you allow an end around the 60-day statute of limitations, then all the concepts that we've brought forward under 512 just go out the window. There's no finality. When the Industrial Commission says your claim is allowed and there's no appeal, there's no finality to that.
Well, don't they actually get more than that? They still get a shot at it, don't they?
They get a shot in mandamus, absolutely.
Well, but they get a shot before the commission by at least presenting it, right?
Absolutely. You get at least three levels in front of the commission.
Persuasive, they would have their remedy regardless of how dilatory they had been.
That's correct. You get a shot in front of the commission. You get two hearing officers and potentially the full commission, and then you get a shot in mandamus. The commission is perfectly able to look at evidence and determine whether fraud has occurred. And the Court of Appeals in this court in mandamus are perfectly able to look at that developed evidentiary record that was developed administratively and determine whether or not the commission abused its discretion.
Thank you, Ms. Porter.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.